Hello and welcome to episode 20 of the Brew and Byte Show, Contextual Computing and the Date at the Apple Store. My name is Craig, and coming up on the show, the panel is back. We're very lucky to be joined by two fantastic guests this week as we discuss everything WWDC. We also have Shorty the Shortcut, Does Pro Mean Pro? And we take a deep dive into the subject of contextual computing and how does it fit into our workflow. But first up, we'll say hello to Martin, that's returned us after swimming all the way from Cornwall last week.
Dried out a fair bit now. Yeah, it wasn't too bad. We were almost blown off the end of Land's End. It was quite intriguing. So pictures to follow. But good evening all.
And next up, we'll also say hello to Alistair. How are you today?
I'm good. Enjoying the nice sunny weather.
Brilliant. And Tina, how are you?
Excited. I want a new laptop.
But you've only just bought one. You can't have another one.
I can.
Brilliant. Thank you. Well, first up, let's say hello to Father, a developer, content creator, a podcasting host, former network specialist for the Marines, and somebody that knows a lot about transcription, as well as recently starting to develop his YouTube channel. Let's say hello to Jay Miller. How are you today?
I mean, you could just say person who mucks around the internet. That's probably a better description of who I am these days.
The list was actually longer. I forgot to add a lover of bowling and fishing, as your CV does tell me.
No more. No more.
I'm going to ask how you have so much time for all these different things next. You know that's coming.
ADHD, that's the answer.
Awesome. And we'll also say hello to one more guest, or should I say an iMore guest. Our second guest this evening has more than a decade writing about technology as such household names as 1Password, Cult of the Mac, iMore, of course, and now helping developers with their press kits. We will say hello to Oliver. How are you this evening?
I'm not bad, thank you. I'm enjoying the calm before the storm that is tomorrow, but I'm okay for now.
Have you got your cups of coffee at the ready?
Coffee, yeah, that's definitely what it'll be.
And I don't think it'll be cups of. I think a cup will do the whole show. Wham, bam, thank you, ma'am.
Yeah, finished.
My question is who's going to be updating all the Twitter feeds? Because the last time I did it for the Mac User Group, I needed a set of new thumbs at the end of the show. I couldn't do it quick enough.
Yeah, it's chaos at the best of times, but hopefully it's worth it by the time we're finished.
We have seen quite a lot of news this week. We are going to briefly touch on WWDC because, yes, we are recording just before it, but there is some interesting things to come. And most importantly, it is our 20th show.
Hey! Hey!
Thank you for all the listeners that have decided to still tune into us every other week. That's much appreciated. But most importantly, let's focus on the Apple news. The first thing we saw this week was some announcements about some more Apple stores. Did anybody see any more information about that?
I saw the one about the one opening in Rome looked quite impressive.
Surely it'd be an interesting dynamic with the changes that's gone on in retail here in this country. I can only really speak about around here. So many places closing. To actually say that you're going to open new shops is a pretty ballsy decision to make. As far as I know, a lot of shopping malls and places like that thrive because they have an Apple store inside them or adjacent to them. And so I'm sure they'll be hoping that Apple do maintain that shop presence. But I think it's a very interesting decision in the current light of the everywhere you listen at the moment, you've got shops being closed or stores being closed down.
What is interesting though, isn't it, that in the local shopping centre in, Westfield in Stratford, they've obviously taken advantage of the shop shutting because they've got Apple Express. So if you have an order that you pick up, you don't go into the main shop. They've got like this little shop and lots of sanitizer and you go and pick up what you want.
Will that maintain or will they?
I don't know. I could see it because you can see, isn't it? I mean, when you think about London, you've got Regent Street and Covent Garden, which are like their flagship shops, and they're huge. Whereas the one in Stratford is not that big. So I can see it would take the pressure off the main store in the shopping centre.
No, true. And the shops themselves have never relied on sales as being their mantra for actually being in existence.
Known a few people that have worked for Apple stores over the years, and they've all said the same thing, is that they don't have, or they didn't have, sales targets like a normal retail outlet. It's just basically to have a presence and it's customer support as much as anything, just having that place where people can go for questions and problems, and people like Microsoft don't have it over here.
The thing I would see, the Westfield near me, Westfield White City, they paid from November to when it got the whole of the shopping center to be open. So they were open 7 days a week to be open for the express. So anyone wanted to come and collect anything, and for Genius Bar appointments, which couldn't be done over the phone. So they were open all the way through. The only day we were closed was Christmas Day, because Westfield is not open on Christmas Day because of trading restrictions. But they paid for all their staff to be employed because they said it was better customer service to do it. So they closed all the other ones in London, just kept Westfield West open, because they said that they still needed to bring a machine in for transfer, or you bought something for Christmas and it doesn't work, we need to transfer that over. And if you think about it, not everyone who's not technical can describe the problem over a telephone or via email chat. So it was good to go in. And the second thing, Apple have always said, it's all about the experience of the store.
Strange, as those who can remember going back pre-Apple Store days, the only one I ever used to use was it Computer Warehouse? And that was like going to an industrial state inside a dark and gloomy showroom. It was a typical computer store. It was, dark and dingy. Nothing like the cathedrals that we now have.
Jay, did you have any Express stores in the US?
Not really. And I think, well, that's not entirely true, I guess. It's a little weird because we have like just to-door delivery. I know when we bought our series of AirTags, which, funny enough, when we ordered them, they were like, well, we can have them to you later today. And it's like, okay, that's great. And it's like, and they'll be delivered to your house. And it's like, even better. I don't have to get up. So I think that there's kind of that weird challenge of, do we, like, we need the stores so that they can drive to us and drop them off on our doorstep instead of us having to, you know, go to brave the mall and figure out what's happening there. And have our forehead scanned at least three times before they let us in and go, why are you here? Even beforehand, the Apple Store, at least our Apple Store, I don't live in a very large town, but we do have an Apple Store there. And I think with that, a lot of the experiences that having an Apple Store in Los Angeles or in the Bay Area, that comes with that, having all the classes and like those great experiences, we don't really have those as much. I think the Apple stores here are very much someone needs to drop something off, kind of like what Oliver was saying, where if you have a problem, you know, you take it to the Apple Store. I often, you know, make once a year trip there to show my wife the latest devices and say, okay, which one do you want? And then, you know, I'm going to get the same thing, but probably with twice as much storage, and, you know, we'll call it a date. And but other than that, I mean,
that sounds more like a permissions trip, Jay, honestly.
Well, I heard the words date in an Apple store there. Yeah. That's the best.
I mean, it's great. You can look and like, I'm getting my shopping list in my head because, you know, now I'm like, which iMac do I want? And it's like, well, probably want to see these in person, so let's schedule an appointment. And it's like, well, I'm not getting an iMac anytime soon, but they'll announce new phones eventually. So let me just make sure I know which ones I want to have my eye on and kind of plan for the future with. But ultimately, I mean, the Apple stores are nice, but I could probably get the exact same features that I get out of my Apple store at any other electronics store. That said, all the other electronics stores are shutting down in our area, so I don't really know what to do.
We have a large chain here, John Lewis, and they usually have an Apple section within their tech space on the floor. And they've definitely had to up their game there. In how that's presented and how it's dealt with. One downside of the Apple stores that we've noticed, I think, in the years that they've been around, it's had a really bad effect on mug groups, because we were the kind of places where people went for support and camaraderie and dealing with issues and problems. And now there's all these wonderful shiny shops with effervescent staff who are all too willing to show off what they can and can't do. And of course, the Genius Bars. And I think it's had an effect on the retainership of membership of mug groups in particular. Though you would, surprisingly, where you haven't got stores, you would have thought it would have boomed, but hasn't been the issue. There's too much support online these days, I suppose.
I think the other side of that, too, is you have a lot more access to that information now, though, where before you had kind of, I mean, if we want to go super old school, you had like a BBS system and then, or you, then you had like a forum. And if you couldn't figure out what you wanted within, you know, an hour, or I guess back in the early days of the internet in a few weeks, you were always looking for what's the fastest route to a solution. And sometimes that was a public user group. But I mean, now, you know, we have some apps in here where I can just say, let me fire off a tweet really quick and then get an answer back within, you know, a few minutes, or let me check out a Reddit forum, or let me check out the forum for the, you know, product on the product's website. And even with Apple, it's like, honestly, I usually go into an Apple store and I have to give them the checklist of all of the troubleshooting steps that I've done beforehand just to prevent, like, is the battery, you know, is the battery reservoir cleaned out? Is, you know, have you plugged it in? Is it charged? And, you know, all of these things. It's like, okay, look, I've done this. I've done the whole eraser trick. You know, I made sure there was no lint in the charging port and power's on for 30 seconds and shuts off. I don't know what's going on. Yes, I've reset to factory settings. Yes, I've done an emergency wipe. But yes, I've done all these things. And they go, okay, yeah, let's just get you a new phone. Because at that point, it's like, well, that's all they know because they're using the same information that I have. I think that it's great that, you know, now user groups can be, I don't want to say fan clubs, but they can be like appreciation groups and groups for discovery of things that are new and not just, you know, have you tried turning it off and on again? It's both good and bad because, like you said, if people don't feel like they need to be a member of that group to get that information, then yeah, they are going to bounce rather quickly. But that just means the people that are here are more dedicated.
You mentioned broken phones there. So did any of us gamble and download the latest beta and have any issues?
I downloaded it. It's been fine so far for me, touch wood. But that's all going to change tomorrow anyway. So
I gambled it on one. This was on the 10S, the Max, and didn't have any issues. And I'm holding out on the 12. But I think, yeah, I think iOS 15 will come before I even get a chance to put that onto the device. I'm intrigued to find out why it suddenly kicked off people's SIM cards. But I don't know if any of you read into it. Rumor has it was something to do with the eSIM in the phone rather than third-party supplier SIM cards. But I'm not willing to gamble that one just yet. It's always fun testing out betas. But interestingly, the public version of the beta doesn't have the issue. So somebody knows something in there.
No, I haven't. I didn't add anything on that I saw that caused any problems, no.
Was it on the Mac version? Was it the Big Sur? The version was 11.14, the one which allows you to boot off an external hard drive again? Wasn't that the one which they were releasing this week?
So 11.4 now lets you boot from an external drive again, but there hasn't been any official comments on that as to why or what the change is. Or does it affect T-chip security devices? There's not been a final answer on that. I don't know if anyone else has come across anything to do with that. I'm intrigued. I'm not going to gamble it on a spare machine just in case.
No, the thing which concerns me is I do the beta testing on an external drive because I do Apple support. I'm an engineer doing Mac and PC as a day job, and I have to often carry external drives with me to test the Mac because often the hard drive is about to die or they want me to test something. And so if I can't boot off an external drive and they're in an area where there's bad internet connection, the only place I can go is the Apple Store. So the Apple Store knows me very well because I'm going in there with clients and saying, we've just spoken to Ireland or Cork. They've said we have to come into the Apple Store. This is the problem. Let's see where to go from there. And I'm very intrigued to see what's going to happen with the new iMacs because the repair system goes on to DFU mode, which is very similar to an iPad or iPhone. So that's going to be intriguing to play with. But the first we get the new iMacs in this country is the end of June. It's a 5-week wait for the first iMacs.
I'm going to ask Jay this question now. How's the delay time on US orders?
I mean, a lot of it just depends on how early you're willing to wake up. If if you're a day one person and you can jump in, then you can usually get it on the shipping date, which is actually funny because I know some people will say that like, oh, it says it's already arrived and it's the day before, which I'm like, hey, those are good problems. However, it does fill up quickly. And that's something that I've always wondered about too, where I don't not believe Apple when they say it's the fastest selling, Object X, whatever they're selling. But I also know from companies like Nintendo where they sell out very, very fast and they delay their, we're backordered for the next several weeks or months. And I wonder, like, a company as big as Apple, they have to have a good idea of what the demand is going to be, right? Like, I don't understand why there's such a delay if you're not before the past couple of years, you have to wake up at, you have to wake up at midnight or stay up till midnight to try and order, or wake up at 4 a.m. and try to order, depending on what part of the U.S. you are in. And I don't even know what that time looks like in the UK. So I'm sure it's probably even worse.
No, it was better for us. We were the lucky ones because it's usually 9 o'clock in the morning for us.
That's amazing. So what you're, so I need to make a trip like every release day. Like that's what I'm hearing.
Do you think that the delay is maybe designed so that after WWDC, they release the public betas to the developers, and then they wait a couple of weeks after, and then they'll release the Gold Master to say this is the new release or this update, and that's why we've delayed the IMAX. So in case there's anything which developers find on the IMAX, that's why there's a 5-week delay. It's possible. It could work out quite well for them.
I think that there's an argument for, has Apple shown a history of giving developers time to adequately prepare for things, especially with the last operating system release of, oh, by the way, iOS 14 coming out tomorrow. Everyone get your Gold Masters in now. I don't think that would be the case just because I don't feel like Apple is, and before I, preach the same statement that Marco Arment said about Apple doesn't care about its developers anymore, I don't think that's the case. I know some of the advocates there. I think they're amazing. I think that Apple has a lot going on, and the developers and them being prepared and the things that might cause some small bugs are probably the least of their worries in that time when they're trying to figure out how to release things and make sure that they can have the smoothest and most marketable release to date. And I think that's the big thing, is they want to be able to say Apple sold out everywhere on day one. Shipment times are pushed back by weeks because that makes people want to say, let me get my order in now instead of thinking about it. Because if it's pushed back till, July now, it'll be November before I get my iMac if I decide to wait a month.
You also have to remember that Tim Cook is the supply chain guru. And that's where he came from. So he's not going to want to have bundles of boxes sitting in warehouses not being sold. So I think there's a bit of both there. I think the developers, the secrecy issues that Apple have, giving out their best secrets to developers is always a bit of a challenge. And I'm sure that gets them going about what's going to be leaked. But also just purely from a physical point of view, they'll want to gauge, which of the 7 colors is going to be the most popular. They won't want to have thousands of orange iMacs that aren't being sold or aren't moving along the supply chain. So I think that's another reason why they don't release them on announcement. It gives them a time to build up some kind of indication as to what supply is needed.
The thing is, there's so many different moving parts as well at the minute, because obviously we've still got plenty of companies still reeling from pandemic problems. Then you had a boat stuck across a canal that caused chaos with shipments. And then you've got the chip shortage that's causing problems left, right and centre. And I think it's a perfect storm at the minute of they just can't build things quick enough. We had AirPods Max turn of the new year. That was another one where if you ordered a pair of those, you had to wait 6 weeks before they come. And then if you wanted to order a certain colour, it'd take 3 months. And I think it's just, it's continuing through the year. I think it'd be interesting to see what the state of play is come September when it's iPhone time, because that'll be the test. That's the one where all the stops will get pulled out. And if we have problems then we know there's a real issue going on somewhere.
And to be fair, they're releasing products at a rate of knots. I've not seen it for such a time that they've got so many new products or upgraded products all coming out at the same time. It's an impressive trick to pull off if you can. And they do seem to have, am I right in saying that people buying Apple products will maybe wait slightly longer? If you're going into PC World to buy a HP laptop, if the HP isn't there, there's at least another half dozen that you might consider looking at and you might be pushed towards. So, you know, whereas if you want an iMac or a Mac Mini, you're going to wait for it.
And the other thing I think about Macs is they tend to follow a routine of when they're going to release things. So they've also got to cope with the fact that once you've been in the universe for a little while, you know that, well, if you want a new phone in June, how much do you want a new phone? Or do you want to wait until October, November and get the latest phone? Because they're quite routine in some areas. They've got to worry about managing the supply because it's all up and down, isn't it? You can see that, you know, who would buy a phone in September?
The other interesting thing about this is that the education markets, and I check with Jerry on this one, but I would imagine that a lot of universities will be buying kits in July to set them up in August, because if you're a university, you tend to do all your maintenance, your repair work, your changing of labs and getting everything ready during the quiet period, which is the long summer holidays. And you're going to start ordering that ahead of time so you can put in the broken stuff or the new kit. And what would be nice is to have an internet room with, you know, all the nice colorful iMacs. So when I was at university, we had the first generation iMac. So we had all the different colors.
You mentioned the idea of having a kind of an internet room that was full of Macs. I think for a lot of colleges these days, they just want an internet room in general. The libraries aren't going anywhere. They're there. They're, you know, full of stuff, and a lot of students use them, and they use a lot of the study rooms and things. But even when I was in college, you know, for the short time that I was there, that was, you know, 12 years ago. And even then, they were removing computers because everybody just brought their own. And I mean, that's, you're definitely right that the time to update equipment, update, you know, all of the logistical stuff, make sure your floors are, you know, scrubbed and everything else is in the time where there's less foot traffic. But I still think that Apple has the same problem that they've been trying to resolve for years, which is, how do we even get our devices into schools? Most colleges and universities, if you don't bring your own device, you're going to use, you know, a dumb terminal that'll have the library lookup, it'll have a browser, and it'll be powered by an Intel Nook, because no matter which way you slice it, you can throw in 100 Nooks for the price of, you know, 10 iMacs. And that's just going to be a better deal for them, especially when they know that the majority of their devices aren't getting used regularly on a day-to-day basis.
Some breaking news that, as some media outlets put it, is, did Johnny Ive design the new iMac?
No one knows. Nobody knows. There's talk that he had a hand in it towards the end, but no one will say how much or what part or exactly when it happened. But I mean, these things are designed so far out that it's entirely possible that it was something to do with him. And if we want to blame him for those silly white bezels, that's fine by me. But who knows? They're supposed to be working together anyway, aren't they still? There's still talk that they signed an agreement where he would still get involved here and there. Again, we've not heard anything about what that looks like or if it even happens or if that was one of those things that you say when someone of his stature leaves and you want to save face, or who knows? He's working with Airbnb last I heard, so could be working at McDonald's by now.
I think you have to say that the Johnny Ive design logic is still there for everyone to see. I don't think they've moved away from his emphasis and ethos a great deal. The system still looks like something he would put his name to.
It does. When you've got to turn the headphone jack sideways to to fit it in because it's longer than the width of the entire machine. That sounds like something he'd do.
Yeah, I think he has a lot to answer for the orange too. Supposedly Johnny Ive is an orange fan. And to be honest, so am I. I like the orange one. If I bought one, it would be orange.
But the original iMac, when it first came out, was it the version C? The orange was the highest in demand. And the lowest demand, can anyone guess the color?
Blue.
Better not be Bondi blue.
Gray.
It was the lime, the green.
Oh, yeah.
Followed by the ruby one. And so they were the ones which a lot of people ended up because it was the colours that no one really wanted because people associated certain colours with depression or other colours with sort of energy. And so they wanted the bright, vibrant colours.
Didn't they do a orange, was it an iBook?
Yeah, they did, yeah.
That clamshell thing they had with that orange handle on it. And I remember looking at it and I thought, there's no way I'm walking down the road carrying that on that handle. I may be an Apple lover, but that's a step too far. Sorry.
It looked like it should have a VTEC logo on it, didn't it?
That's right.
the question of if Johnny Ive had anything to do with the design of this, has Johnny Ive become the new quote-unquote, well, Steve wouldn't have done it this way, you know, victim at this point? I feel like there's a lot to say about, like, Apple has a design language and Johnny Ive has a lot to do with that language. No one is coming in with a brand new idea and they go, all right, this time the iMac's going to look like an octagon. And they go like, oh, it's brilliant. It's such a revolutionary idea. No one's doing that. They're looking at a gigantic PDF that just says, all right, here's how Apple products should look. They should either have like no hard edges. They should be as thin as possible. iPhone jack optional, but you know, like follow the instructions on the book and then find the blanks that are empty here. And then we'll fill them with new design ideas. And over time, you'll slowly adopt new things as the technology improves. I don't think that Johnny Ive's design language or ideas had as much to do with the fact that this system is as small as it is, as much as the iPad Pro. We see a lot of the cooling technology that looks very similar to what the iPad Pro had with the little vents trying to push it down outwards, working with silent fans and bringing the decibel levels down. That's something you always want to do. But now we have the technology to do more of those. The display, the technology behind it, all of these things. It's not a Johnny Ive thing. It's an Apple thing. And I think we kind of forget that because, the great designer left. So from now on, we're allowed to have color again, which is great. That might be the one decision that Johnny Ive like didn't have much of an agreement to of like, oh, everything needs to be space gray or silver. So yeah, if Johnny Ive had anything to do with this design, it's the fact that there's still a silver iMac that's available. But other than that, does it matter at the end of the day? I'm just wondering.
Do you remember when the MacBooks came out? The number one color that everyone wanted to get was the black. They tried to get the black MacBook and they said they just couldn't get it where it wasn't peeling off. Because remember the MacBooks, it would sort of that outer case would peel off. The black one had that sort of sophistication. And do you remember it was more expensive to buy than the white one? But the other one, which is interesting, is the product Reds is one of the highest demand products. So we've never had a red MacBook. So we've got phones, which are red, but we've not had any red desktops or laptops. And so could you imagine that? That would be a big statement, couldn't it? You could have.
They've done some strange things with the product Red. I mean, we had the spell where the red ones would come out 6 months after the model launched. We still don't get product Red Pros of any description. So if you want Red, you have to get mid-range model. You can't get the high-end model. And I've just never understood that. I can't, like you said, the product Reds are always popular. They always look brilliant. I'd happily buy a Red 13 Pro in September. Day one, no problem, no questions asked. I wouldn't need to see one. That'd be it, done. But it just never seems to happen.
Because remember Ferrari released, they teamed up with, was it Acer? And they produced the Ferrari Reds. They licensed it. It was the highest selling Acer laptop in the market. Even though there are other laptops, which were Windows, which were better than it, people loved the fact that it was red. When I asked someone, why did you buy a red one? They said, because when you go through the airport and everyone's putting their laptops on the to go for security check, they could see theirs because it was bright red. It'd be silver, 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 black, red. They knew which one to
pick. One upmanship in the security channels. I love it.
Okay. So as we sit on the eve of WWDC, I'm going to ask the question, what is the next OS going to be called? And I want one guess from each person and see who gets the closest.
Let's go with something different. We've done a bunch of mountains. We've done these landscapes. I want some busy city life. Let's go like macOS Malibu.
Oh, that's got such a nice feel to it. That feels like you could be using your Mac and drinking a cocktail, you know, pina colada time. Oh, I like that.
The one I think would be great is if they went OS Monterey and you went for a yellow iMac, you could then have Monterey Jack.
The one that comes to mind, I would think that maybe Golden Gate.
Carmel, that'd be quite nice. Sophisticated, quite expensive.
It's going to be Mammoth or Monterey. I think that's pretty much guaranteed, based on trademarks that they've got hanging around and ones that they've let elapse. So whichever one you fancy out of that pair, Mammoth.
I had the same suggestion as Martin. I'd like to see him call it macOS Golden Gate. That would be my suggestion. And I can just see the wallpaper being the bridge.
I'm afraid of that direction, though, because if you keep going with landmarks, eventually you'll hit macOS Alcatraz and nobody wants that.
You mean to say we're not locked into a system already?
I mean, it is an island, so...
is there any weird islands off California which haven't been named? We've had Catalina, so...
My next question. Oliver, you're in the realm of news and tech updates. What would be your most requested thing from WWDC?
That's a tough one. If we're going to get hardware, 16-inch MacBook Pro, definitely. Been waiting for that to happen for too long with whatever processor they want to put in it. I suspect it's going to be something beyond M1, whether it's M1X, M2, whatever they end up calling it. Software-wise, iOS 15 is going to be the highlight for me. I love getting new iOS releases to play with. I just want something to change on the lock screen. I've always wanted... I remember having a Motorola Android phone years ago during the dark days, and having an always on screen and interactive widgets and that kind of thing. And iOS 15, I'm hoping, is going to sort of take what we got from iOS 14 and go a step further. I'm hoping we'll get something sort of like complications on the lock screen kind of thing. And I'd take that. I'd be happy with that, to be honest with you.
Awesome. And Jay, what would you suggest as being your most look forward to thing?
I'm kind of, I don't want to say underwhelmed this year, but... there isn't really much that I'm hoping for. Call it a talk year, call it a year that they just solidify everything else. I mean, we were talking earlier about issues with, you know, computers crashing and boot loops and things like that. They just got Apple Silicon out. It's the fastest, most reliable question mark system. I want them to remove that question mark. I want them to just say, hey, we're going to give people an extra year to provide as much support for Apple Silicon as possible. I know it's not the fun or sexy answer, but it's kind of the answer I'm looking for of like, I just want to make sure that when I do retire this old Intel 16-inch MacBook and pick up a 16-inch M1, that all of my systems that I have to move over aren't going to immediately like stop working. And I don't think that they can do that if they keep, you know, pushing ahead, which I get it. Like you have to, it's competitive. You have to stay competitive, but I feel like they're more competitive on iOS, on iPadOS. Well, iPadOS, they're like king of the hill because there's not really much in the tablet space outside of an iPad. So yeah, I just want them to solidify the operating system for macOS and say, you know what, we've fixed a lot of stuff under the hood. It's going to be more reliable. It's going to be the expected performance all of the time.
I just want some nice software updates. iPad OS, please do something better with it. I'm getting a little bit frustrated with it. And that is something I use all the time, sometimes more than being on a Mac. If I had a wish list, I want to see Shortcuts, but for Mac OS.
A lot of people are shouting that Shortcuts on Mac OS is coming. I don't know if there's any, you know, anything behind the scenes that show that, but I've had this conversation on Mac Voices a few times. I think what they're waiting for is a more connected system between iOS, iPadOS, and macOS. And I'm not saying they all got to be one system, but I think with the introduction of Catalyst, Catalyst apps were bumpy getting off the ground. Swift UI will help a lot, you know, in some of that those features. But I think what they want is the ability to say that if you have a shortcut on your iPhone, if you have a shortcut on your iPad, you should be able to port that over to your Mac and it should just run. And in order to do that, they have to make sure that the applications that are on iOS and that are on iPadOS can run in some way, shape, or form on macOS and are set up for that. And I think they are close. So I do think it's coming, but I don't think it's coming this year. I think they're going to want to introduce something on the developer side that says, okay, we've given you a little bit more assistance in getting your iOS device, your iOS apps ported over to the Mac so that they do feel like native apps. Because I don't know, I've seen people show off their, hey, look at this iOS app on my Mac. And it's like, it doesn't look like it really belongs there. I think they want it to feel like it belongs there first. And then that's when they'll go, shortcuts. We're killing Otto the Automator and we're bringing out, you know, Shorty the Shortcut. And, you know, we'll have a great time there.
I think you are right in some of that. I think it may be that we have to see an entire product line of M chips and maybe the year after that they push it slightly further, because for someone that loves shortcuts and automation things, there are some big hiccups in that I have to have the same workflow process for iOS and then I have to have a different app doing the same thing for macOS, and it is frustrating. I agree with you on that for sure. What would Alistair's suggestion be?
So I was thinking about this one, and I think on iOS, I would say the two requests I would have on iOS are this. One, when you take a screenshot, when you save it to files or somewhere else on iCloud, you could actually give it a name, because at present it's calling it something PNG. And then you have to go on your Mac and it comes up with a stupid error which says, would you like to save this file even though it's got the same name as another screenshot you just took 5 minutes ago? Two, second one, I would like Safari to be able to deal with certain web pages or certain archaic pages which still insist that you have to go onto an Apple computer to look at the website. I would say as the macOS, I would say reliability would be good, because we've seen so many issues with Bluetooth, so many issues with wireless keyboards. That sort of reliability, a slightly more pro version of iTunes, you know, like iTunes of old, because the current iTunes, you can't see all the, you know, what genre it is, or because if we're going to a better audio, we've got the new headphones, it would be nice if we had on iOS, because on the Mac, you can do your own customized equalizer. Why can't we do that on the iPhone or the iPad? Because we're getting high-end music, which we can now get, and high-end headphones. Wouldn't it be nice to have a nice little equalizer? But that's just my own personal preference.
Ah, but would Tina want high-end headphones to work with high-end audio? At the moment, there is currently a big problem with that.
I think I'm looking forward to, if there's hardware, I want to see what they produce for the 16-inch MacBook Pro. That's my focus. Even though it's old-fashioned, if there was a version of MagSafe, I would like that. You know, that's one of the earliest adverts I can remember. The one where Mac doesn't break his leg and PC does. Because it just strikes me, safety-wise, it's just really clever. You know, having an SD slot would be nice. And having the speed to deal with, you know, big files. So that's what I'm looking for.
Well, I'd like a new form of boot camp so that you could run on an iPad either iOS or you could run macOS. Since they're putting the same chips into both, surely there must be a way that you could choose which system you want to use. I'd love to see macOS on the iPad, because then all the pro apps you could run on your iPad. And the other thing I'd like to see Apple bring in is similar to their phone system, I'd like to be able to swap my MacBook Pro each year for the new version as it comes out.
Okay, you got me on that one. I like that one.
Yeah, great program.
The thing that I'm hearing from most of us at being like professional users is that we want professional tools. We want our professional tools to feel like they're designed and reliable and performant as professional tools. And it's not to say that what we don't have isn't better than what it's been, but I do think that there is a divide between not the Steve Jobs Apple, but the Apple of old and the Apple of now. Apple is the wealthiest company in the world. Its job now is to make sure that it continues to be the wealthiest company in the world and that it somehow creates more people on the planet to sell these products to. Until they can achieve that goal, they have to figure out who isn't buying their products and how do they get them to buy their products. I don't think the goal for Apple at this point is to make the Apple fans, the Apple pros, want to go out and buy more Apple devices. I think very much it is, how do I get the people who can't be bothered with macOS to buy an iPad? How can I get the people who can't be bothered with their Android devices to now join the Apple ecosystem? How do I get someone whose child only has an Apple Watch? How do I convince their parents to upgrade them to an iPhone SE? I feel like that's the market. And I mean, again, I work for a marketing department. I am not a marketer for Apple, so I can't speak on their behalf. But I feel like if they want to remain in this field where services are the most important thing, you have to be able to sell those services to somebody. And the same people that you sell those services to, they're just going to want something that's going to play their movies faster, listen to their music better, and ultimately get out of their way in terms of all of the other performance stuff. They're not really going to care about all the professional apps that are out there. And it's not a Apple's lost its way. It's a Apple has new responsibilities that it has to think about. I feel like that's the hard part with this. If I'm trying to like keep my expectations low and just be like, all right, let me think like someone who has trillions of dollars and their job is to make more trillions of dollars. How do I do that? And sadly, it's none of the things that any of us have asked for. So that's kind of a challenge.
But surely, if that was the case, all they have to do is remove the Apple tax. If they really wanted to go for bulk and sell that quantity and catch the other 90% who don't buy Apple products.
I don't think they can do that because then they lose the status symbol. Yeah.
I mean, Apple will argue that the MacBook Air, the Mac Mini, that's that market. That's what they're aiming those two machines at. The Mac Mini was always supposed to be that switcher machine, wasn't it? It's like, bring your own crappy monitor, bring your own crappy keyboard, plug it in, you've got a Mac. Whether they were priced low enough is a different matter. And the MacBook Air is what is it, still the best-selling laptop on the planet? People are buying them, clearly. Priced at what, is it $1,000 these days or $900 for a MacBook Air low-end? The weird thing about Apple at the moment is Pro doesn't mean Pro anymore. Pro means more expensive. And to start to get to proper Pro machines, you're talking iMac Pro, which is now dead and buried. And then obviously you get to Mac Pro, which is $6,000 before you start adding anything useful. And there's that big gap between MacBook Pro, which is MacBook but better, and then the proper Pro machines, which in laptop world there isn't one. And then you start getting up to sort of silly money for Mac Pros. And I think finding a way to make that MacBook Pro fit everything that pro photographers, videographers want is something that they've got further and further away from over the last few years. And if the rumors are right, we're going to start to get back towards that now with HDMI ports, SD card slots. We're never getting Ethernet back, but we're getting ports back at least, whereas we've spent the last however many years taking them away. And I think it's promising. I'm looking forward to seeing what this next round of MacBook Pro type devices looks like, because I think it might give us something back that we lost over the last 5 years. And it'll be interesting then to see where we go from there. And I'm most interested to see what the prices are, because for years we've had Intel's processors bumping prices up, especially when you look at like the Mac Pro of that £5,000, $5,000 price. How much of that is a Xeon chip? You whip that out and shove an M1X or whatever in, will the Mac Pro get cheaper because the overheads are lower? Maybe, knowing Tim Cook, probably not. But you could see the same thing with the rest of the lineup. And that's where we come back to the cheaper machines. Could the MacBook Air get cheaper? And could it compete with your Acers or your Lenovo's or whatever the PC world's buying these days? It's always that balancing act between, well, we've got the chance of making more money, or do we sell more by making it cheaper? And that's why people like Tim Cook and co get paid a load of money to make those decisions, and I talk about it on podcasts.
I think the interesting thing is the fact that the new M1 chip has thrown all of that scenario and that level and that kind of thinking line out the window. A colleague of mine has got himself an M1, run some tests, not benchmark tests, but real-world tests of doing stuff in Final Cut Pro. and the little Mac Mini was five times faster than the old Mac Pro trash can that they had, which was fully kitted. That was a top range kit that he used for video processing. And the Mac Mini absolutely thrashed it. So what you're saying is quite right. How are they going to justify a Mac Mini compared to the Mac Pro at, what, nearly 10 times the price? All of that is going to be thrown out the window. It's going to be a new brave world, I think, about what you can and can't afford.
Apple Silicon sort of finally gives Apple what it's wanted to do for years, and that's get away from speeds and feeds. It doesn't matter how much RAM you've got these days, because 8 gig in the lowest, well, the entry level MacBook Air, MacBook Pro, Mac Mini. Everyone looked at that and thought, including me, thinking that's no way that's enough for most people. That's going to be chopping and changing constantly. And yeah, it will do, but it's got SSD and it's sat next to chip, and it's like lightning, and you can't tell the difference whether it's swapping or not. And no one's going to care. It doesn't matter. It's just a machine. It's an appliance. It's a kettle. It's a microwave. It just doesn't matter anymore. It's that quick. Nobody cares. And then you start selling on features like SD card slots, connectivity, portability, colours, that kind of thing. And that's what we'll start looking at in future. It won't be how quick it is, because everything's quick. And it doesn't matter which one you buy.
It'll be interesting, though, because I watched lots of reviews on the comparing the MacBook Pro with the MacBook Air, and lots of people said that there wasn't enough of a differential. You know, why would you pay that much extra for the MacBook Pro?
That M1 MacBook Pro is a machine that I don't think needed to exist. It seemed to be put out as a stopgap until whatever gets announced, because they didn't want the Air to be beating the Pro that you could buy next to it in an Apple store.
So there's a couple of interesting things which I think we'll probably see. So we're going to have some mention of accessibility, so that will either be mental health, audio hearing, or some disability mentioned at some point, because that's what their current theme is. The second thing we're going to see is, with this new M series, what have we been able to achieve? So it'll be some sort of grand target. But the other interesting thing was, the reason they had to make the Pro indicator was, when they had that lineup originally, remember you had the iMac was the consumer grade, and then you had the higher, you know, the G3 to G4s. So they had to have a distinguisher. Then you had the iBooks and then the Mac Pros, because you needed to distinguish them, and they were slightly more expensive chips, and you had to explain that. And then when asked some time back what was the most popular MacBook Pro being sold, it was the 2011 / 2012 MacBook Pros. Those were the most popular at the time. Everyone had them. It was the most popular one. And I think the biggest problem we had was that things sort of went downhill, because they were trying to sort of cover everything, you know, go for the thinnest, slightest type of computer. And then they discovered that the people who bought those type of computers didn't really care about Apple, and it wasn't looking good for Apple. They were just sort of like, oh, I don't like it now. You know, it was just simple as far as they were concerned. And I'd be very interested to see where they move to, and whether they're kind of have a look at, like, this is the roadmap for the next 5 years. This is where we're planning and going with this. Be interesting to see how they sort of utilize their dominance on that market, especially as we don't know who's going to be buying on.
There are lots of things you can look at. The webcam. What's that all about?
I love that.
Yeah, you know, with now things like Zoom calls, Skype, Teams, whatever your video calling app of choice is, Messenger, whatever, a lot of that's going to remain. So there'll be some things I think that they should be looking at changing relatively easily, you would hope. But that said, you know, my sister's going to be distraught that the touch bar is going, because she loves it. It's the things you don't notice. I mean, I've got the MacBook Air. I just don't notice now that when I switch it on, that, you know, I put my finger over the on button and it just reads my fingerprint. Whereas I had, when I was still in the Windows world, I had a Sony one with this stupid fingerprint reader that never worked. It is how seamless the experience is. I think that's what I find hard saying to people that aren't in the Mac universe. You know, the fact that if I change a bookmark on one laptop, it updates on the next one, so that I don't even think about it. All the stuff it does in the background, I don't think about, you know, making everything all work together seamlessly, which when it doesn't work is very irritating.
So our main feature for today was to look at a slightly different subject in terms of contextual computing. So not necessarily a feature in macOS or iOS, but a way of how we use our machines
And I thought I would ask Jay what his opinion or view of contextual computing is.
I feel like you got the budget David Sparks on this one, because a lot of my opinions will wind up coming from some of the work that he's done. I have recently been on kind of a wide array of contextual computing thought and setup. As Craig mentioned in the introduction, there's a lot going on in my life. A little less now that we're post-pandemic times, you know, a lot of things have kind of faded, but there's always a lot going on. And how do I change from Jay Miller, the father, the husband, to Jay Miller, the developer advocate and developer, to Jay Miller, the psycho tweeter, to Jay Miller, the podcaster, to Jay Miller, the YouTuber? And how do I keep everything kind of balanced? How do I know where I'm going to be able to find things? And there have been a lot of tools that have come out lately that really help in that process. And I know that we have a few in here that we'll probably jump into. But to me, the idea of contextual computing is putting yourself in kind of a mode state of, when Jay the podcaster is here, all of the other things that Jay does have to go away. Because if they don't, then, you know, I'm not able to focus fully on doing the podcasting things. And then when it is time to switch over from Jay the podcaster to Jay the YouTuber, I, you know, hit some buttons, flip some switches, turn some dials, and it's really not that glamorous. I think I just type in a couple of commands. But then the things that go away from that, Jay the podcaster stuff disappears, and now Jay the YouTuber stuff now appears. And I have all the applications. They're laid out the way that I want them to be laid out. The email is, you know, muted and do not disturb is turned on. And I can focus on the recording, the editing, the B-roll, and all that other stuff that comes up. And it's being able to switch in and out of those modes, whether it's different devices, different applications, maybe even different operating systems. I mean, I haven't gone that crazy yet, but I'm sure there's someone. I mean, I guess the best way to think about it is, if you ever worked for an IT department for an all Windows company, and you would prefer to be on a Mac, in a way you are switching. You're switching from Windows administrator to Mac enthusiast. This is just doing something similar to that, but all within the same ecosystem.
I think that really sums up what the idea of contextual computing is. I don't know if some of the other members of the panel use it in a different sense or see it in a different way. For me, I see it more about being more organized or productive. I would say it's also a massive time saver, but there is kind of an argument of, oh my gosh, it looks so complicated, it takes forever to set up. I'd love to hear what other people think of how they go about doing that, or how do you save time?
The only thing I do use is the different desktops available in OS. So if I am doing, like you say, if I'm doing video work where I'm doing a podcast, then I need to see my files. I need to see, obviously, got Final Cut Pro, and I might need some internet connections. That's what I want to concentrate on. And then when I'm doing my general office work stuff and accounts and all that kind of stuff, then all that, as Jay said, needs to go away. Don't annoy me. Don't bug me with stuff I don't need to know about. I could do that being tighter, because it's all too easy to be dragged off into side streams and rabbit holes and stuff like that when you're, and you're, it's impacting on the work you do. So from that point of view, yes, it would be nice to see a way of doing that. And I've tried different bits and pieces of ways of doing that. Automator I tried to use to section off what I want to do, but haven't found it easy to do. And it, to me, I'm not a great coder or programmer or anything like that, just an ordinary user. I find it difficult to get all that in a workable system.
So the things I do, I think those, the only things I do at the moment is I have a geotagged location, so that as soon as I leave my house, the Wi-Fi and Bluetooth goes off, because I don't need it when I'm traveling, and it's to save battery life. But it's a bit sort of hit and miss at times. It doesn't always seem to work, so I'd like it to be a bit more reliable. So maybe it's just the way I'm coding it with shortcuts. But I have tried in different ways. I mean, I do a very sort of simple way. I have a series of different desktops, and I will say iTunes open in this desktop, email open in that one, Photoshop in this one, because I can be jumping between three or four spaces simultaneously. And in order not to get distracted, I will have everything open in their own space, so I don't get distracted in what I'm currently doing. The other thing I found was that you almost have to watch a video to find out what it's capable of doing. Because it's all very well someone talks about it, but you need to know what the capacity it can do in order to go, oh, that's useful. Oh, that would save me time. You know, I'm not going to go read the manual because that's too boring. So I want someone to show me in 5 minutes what I can do with this thing. And then I could go, yay, because that's a sort of the fun, sort of exciting way of doing it. I mean, what was it? The fastest way I learned about Evernote was, okay, I went and tried to collect everything and stick it in Evernote. And then sort of, oh, I want this web page. I want to do this. Because the biggest problem I had was you go and create a load of bookmarks. And then you forget, which computer did you store the bookmarks on? Was it my MacBook Pro, my Mac Pro, my G3, my G4? Was it in Firefox, Safari, or Chrome? And so you're having to hunt where this page was. And so just sticking into Evernote when it was a big thing, 2012, I thought that was excellent because I could say that's what I need to look when I'm on the move and when I was traveling. So I'll be intrigued to see what has changed, what has moved on, because at present I'm sort of not the most automated as I could be.
Would you say it's device specific in terms of automation or what you can and can't do? Because let's say 85-90% of the population is probably carrying some form of smartphone at this point.
I don't want to say that it's device specific on what you can and can't do. Other than writing code, because Apple still just hasn't provided a great way of doing that on an iOS device other than remoting into your macOS device and doing it. But I don't think that it's necessarily device specific on what you can and can't do. I think it's device specific on how you do it. And I think that that's something that in the realm of Apple, it is still very hard to do no matter which device you're using. I think as a few people have mentioned here, you almost have to devote your life to becoming an automation guru to really utilize these tools in a way that makes sense. Often, I mean, most of my friends are those automation gurus, so it's kind of hard for me to think outside of that box where I'm like, hey, I want to do this thing and this thing and this thing, and then all of a sudden you have like 50 shortcut blocks, you know, in this long thing that says, solve all J's problems, click here to add untrusted shortcut. But there's a lot going on in both the Mac ecosystem and the iOS ecosystem. And I think the story there is a little muddied. Of course, shortcuts solves a lot of the questions on how do you do a thing, but how do you get that data ready for shortcuts at times? What if the app doesn't support shortcuts? What if, you know, all of a sudden, you know, my wife and I use a meal planner, and not to push any, you know, gender norms or whatever, I prefer to cook. My wife prefers to go shopping and buy the groceries. So I often know what we need, but she's the person getting them. And the app that we use to plan our meals doesn't support shortcuts. So how do I take this list of ingredients that I'm going to need for the week and send them to my wife so that she can add them to her favorite, you know, shopping list application of choice? And will it be prepared for that? And the answer is often, maybe. And sadly, I think that in a world of context computing, you maybe is like the worst place to be in. Do I have this file? Maybe. Do I have the application I need installed? Maybe. Like, I can't work with that. And I think that that's where this idea of saying, like, I have to think of so hard before I even begin to set up these processes. I think that's what prevents people from ever jumping in. It's not the device. It's not the operating system. It's, okay, let me do my mise en place. Let me get all my ingredients and lay them out in front of me and make sure I have everything I need before I ever get started. And I think that Apple has to make that a little bit easier. I think the content creators need to stop trying to write magnum opuses and, you know, making these videos that are just like, I built the Berlin Wall using shortcuts in 15 steps, and start going with, here's how you start with the basics. And do more of those things.
I'm going to ask Oliver how he deals with all of his research and recording documentation for all of his articles. I'm intrigued to understand how this works.
I go through spells with this sort of stuff. I go through weeks where I get really into it and I spend more time tweaking and messing around and trying to automate things than actually doing work. And then I go the complete opposite way and just throw it all away and do everything manually instead. I don't think we've ever really got to the point that we were promised a couple of WWDCs ago where we'll be able, cereals say that, oh, this is the time you normally have your coffee and I'll order it for you from the nearest Starbucks and it'll be ready for when you get there and it'll do it all automatically. And that never happened, did it? And I mean, my phone can't even tell me the basic things. I don't think Siri suggestions ever really worked from beta one through to now. So I don't know. I have a love-hate relationship with that kind of thing. I like the idea. It seems brilliant in theory. I've never been able to make any of it work properly. But I think that's partly my own lack of patience more than anything. I think Jay Spahn, when he says that sometimes we get people that get far too into the weeds with building mini apps out of shortcuts, I can think of one very prominent person that tends to do that kind of thing, and things that they make are, they're apps, they're not shortcuts anymore, they're apps. And I think if you get to the point of trying to wrangle iOS or iPadOS to the point of doing something that it was never meant to do through a shortcut, then maybe you should just do it on a Mac instead. But that's me being old-fashioned.
I'm gonna give some kind of insight or some behind the scenes to how some of the things work for the podcast. You all received some show notes prior to that. They are entirely constructed with shortcuts on iOS. It has 109 actions and it literally goes off, pulls all the information that I would ever need to put together a show. But Jay hit the one topic that really bugs me, is how to get different information into the shortcut, which is probably the hardest thing. And I'm going to ask him if he has any ideas or suggestions of what works nicely in terms of getting information in and out of different apps. I'm going to throw the argument out there now.
I don't think we have enough time on this show, so we might have to do that later. But wow. And I mean, that's why I don't think shortcuts is ready for the Mac yet. Because, you know, like you said, to do a thing on your iOS device, it took 109 actions when $20 a month in a Zapier subscription could probably do a lot of that work for you. And again, it's one of those things that once you've figured it out, once you've built that 109 actions, two things have happened. One, you've wasted a whole lot of time figuring it out. Well, I guess I shouldn't say wasted. You've learned a lot in that process. But then the other side of that is, what happens when you decide, to unveil a little bit more about what we're doing? We're using Zencastr. What happens when, you know, you decide we're no longer using Zencastr, you're now using something like Squadcast, or you're now using something like, I don't know, StreamYard or VidYard or whatever. Now you have to figure out, okay, what do I need to throw out that's no longer relevant here? What do I need to replace it with? How is that even possible? And, you know, like Oliver said, at some point you got to get down to just doing the thing. So you don't build the shortcut anymore. And then the shortcut is broken. And then you truly have wasted a bunch of time because your 109 action shortcut is no longer usable. And you're just like, I spent all this time developing it and now I don't use it. So what was the point to begin with?
That brings up an interesting point, actually. I'm trying to remember who said it, and I can't for life remember who it was. But I remember someone asked them, what's the first app that you install when you get a brand new Mac, when you open it up, take the screen wrap off, what do you install? And is it Launch Bar, or is it Alfred, or is it whatever? And they're like, no, I refuse to install any of those apps, because that means that I'm then reliant on that app. I can't work without that app being installed, and I want to be able to walk up to any Mac and be able to use it as quickly as it can mine. And I think that's an interesting angle to it, of that if you're not careful, you rely so heavily on all these different automations, all these different tweaks and quirks, and that it just, what happens when it breaks, or what happens when it's not available, or what happens when some back-end servers didn't respond quick enough so that 109 action shortcut doesn't work. The idea is that we do these things to make repetitive tasks easier and quicker and less repetitive, which is fine while it works. But when it doesn't, then it's a whole different kettle of fish.
Considering I just have a freshly installed Mac, I'm actually prepared to answer that question. I install Kraft first. Inside of Kraft, there's a document that I have that says new machine. And in big bold letters, it says, before you do anything, like, here's the list of all of the applications that you run that are vital to like what you're doing. And I've still missed some. I realize that as I've gone through my process and I go to do something and it's like, oh, that app's not installed. Well, need to add that to the list. But again, it is such a, it's a minefield to mess with, because as I mentioned, I thought I had the list, and well, I do have the list. It's just incomplete. And it's really hard to go, oh, well, I don't use this app anymore, and I replace this app with this other app over here. And Apple has kind of solved a lot of that with backups and all this other stuff. And they're making backups a little bit easier to do and deal with. That said, it's not perfect. Again, it's if you want to even believe that you can go down this contextual computing pathway, it's almost like becoming a monk. You must first climb the mountain and accept the task. And then once you've done that, only now are you ready to truly become, you know, someone who can master the arts of contextual computing. But otherwise, you'll only just play in the garden a little bit.
It's interesting you picked up on the whole installing a fresh Mac idea. So I've played with this in two ways. So one, building like a deployment image so that it installs all the installer files, or another way of looking at it, and this was kind of a play more than anything, was trying to use Keyboard Maestro to go off and then start installing or pulling all of the usual apps that I would put on a fresh machine, which is kind of much of a play more than it is anything. But the App Store has caused havoc with that if you don't use third-party installers.
I would say that there's one of the automators that everyone uses on a regular basis is Spotlight, because there's more to Spotlight than what Search used to do. In Spotlight, you've got the ability to say, okay, open up text edit. So you do command space, you write in T-E-X-T, then you hit enter and it automatically opens up. It's done a series of steps that it's automated straight into your operating system. The amount of times I use that and the amount of times I would use that for being a calculator, I can just type in the calculation straight into Spotlight and it does the calculations on the fly, and I've not had to open up calculator. It's that type of automation which I love, and it's those sort of fast, quick actions which I think Apple was superb at. And when I'm switching between Mac and PC, it's those things that really drive me mad, because Windows Search is not helpful. It doesn't do any of that, and it just drives you mad. But at the moment, it's a sort of, well, this is a sort of pet project we're doing, but we're not quite sure if we want to do it or not. So whoever did the Siri side obviously doesn't listen to different accents, because the amount of times you say something and it mishears and it spells it differently, or if you're doing voice prediction and you're saying your text message and the amount of times it transposes different words, you've come across it and you're reading someone's text message and you're going, right, you've dictated this via voice, because it doesn't make sense. Or it doesn't pick up someone's accent. So we have automation automatically built in, and contextualization, it knows where you are. But I would love it to know simple things like, okay, we've already got one and it knows that you're traveling and turns off notifications. But could we adjust that one to say, I'm on the bus rather than, or I'm on the tube. So can you turn off all the Wi-Fi so you're not going to drain the battery life? Or when I'm here, can you turn on the Bluetooth? Simple, helpful things like that would be very nice.
What's interesting with all of this, though, is finding it. For most people, automation is scary because you don't know what it is. And yet there are things that are automation. But sometimes the worry is that it's going to take over. And that's the problem about I have with any form of automation, is that loss of control. Sometimes I'd rather do it myself, because at least I know where I've put it. At least I know by arranging it, it's how I want it.
It's interesting you say that, especially in terms of location, because I've been exploring this a lot more recently. And I went down the route of getting some cheap NFC tags to do some interesting things. An example that I use is, say, the Wi-Fi name has the word free in it, so that when I connect to the Wi-Fi, it will automatically turn on the VPN so that it's far more secure. Or this comes back to Alistair's on the bus comment. I took advantage of the free Wi-Fi that's on the tube in London so that my phone knows when I get to the station, it will turn on and off the Wi-Fi, or it will connect directly securely to something. And it's purely location based rather than anything else. I don't know if Jay has anything along those types.
I'm a homebody, so no, I don't tend to leave the house that much. And I agree that I think Apple is doing this in some ways. I mean, I think the one that I can always think of is whenever I get in my car and it connects to my car's Bluetooth, it pulls up maps and says, hey, are you wanting to go to this location? And usually it's right, depending on what day it is and what, you know, I guess I'm a very trackable person these days. But, you know, whenever I'm farther away from home than I normally am, and it says, oh, hey, by the way, it's an hour and a half until home. Would you like directions? And sometimes, yeah, I would, because there might be an alternate route that I can take. But I think that Apple, in some ways, are doing these things. We may not know it, and I'm not sure. I might have to lean on Oliver's research to know more about that. But I could have sworn they mentioned that some of the things they do are processor optimization, so that if you're not using certain radios or certain, you know, processes, they just shut them off until you use them again. And because it's fast enough that, like, you know, when you go to do it again or when you go to turn it back on, they can cut it back on again, you know, without you ever noticing. And that's how they try to bring some of those performance improvements to your systems.
I know they do that with the 5G radios on the new phones, don't they, where 5G is turned off if it's not deemed required. And then as soon as there's a spike in throughput, it connects back to 5G, and that's where your extra data comes from. Because obviously 5G is a battery hog at the best of times. But these phones are so quick these days that they can turn off cores, turn cores back on when needed, and that kind of thing.
Does anyone have any particular contextual apps that you use the most, or that you think you've got the most out of?
Oy, I've climbed that mountain. So right now there's a few. Now it's just a matter of choosing which ones. I'm gonna say the two that I say all the time, Bunch and Hook. Bunch puts me in a contextual computing state. Hook keeps me there. These are both Mac apps. There aren't iOS versions of it, which I think there's talk about Hook having one, but that's not necessarily a thing yet. But the thing I like about Bunch, and this is something that has happened before, there are other apps that do this. Bunch just works the way my brain does. Let's say if you're going into a podcast, I know, you know, Craig, to pick on you a little bit. When you go into a podcast, certain things always have to be open. Probably Twitter, so you can DM the person if they haven't joined the call yet. A URL that takes you into the call recording software or the call recording system. And you may want to turn on Do Not Disturb. You may want to load whatever document you have prepared for that episode. Bunch gives you the ability to do that all within a text document. You just say, you know, using its language, which again, it's a mountain to climb, so you have to learn the language. It's pretty simple, but you still got to learn it. Open these apps, open these URLs. You can even enter certain commands, turn off these system settings. And then when I close that Bunch, turn all that stuff off and get me back to where I was.
But what is it about Hook that you like?
The thing I like about Hook is that it utilizes a lot of the systems of old, including Apple scripts and things like that, to do what it does. But let's say if I'll pick on Oliver only because I like the stuff he writes. But if Oliver's working on a project and he's doing research and, you know, he goes down these rabbit holes of, you know, this link takes him to this link that takes him to this link that takes him to this link that takes him to this link. If he has a tool like Craft or, you know, some type of text doc, even if it's just a regular text document, and he has it in BBEdit or TextMate or whatever, he can hook all of those URLs that he's visited to that text document. And from there, when he goes and opens up that document again, he goes, oh, what was that link that I was looking at, you know, 3 weeks ago? He just has to activate Hook again, and there's a list of all of the things that he's connected to that item. So he doesn't have to start digging through emails. He doesn't have to start jumping on Twitter and scrolling and then all of a sudden see something, which if you know, he has a brain like mine, which is very wild, that's where research projects go to die, is the second I had to go on Twitter to look up something. So I love the ability of Hook to just say, you know, I'm working on the London Mac User Group's podcast, and I know that they have a bunch of apps that we're going to talk about. While I'm doing my research, I can hook all of those back to the original email, so that when I'm in it, I can just say, oh yeah, what was that again? Activate hook, and it's this one. Click, and then I'm there. So it's more of a defense tool to not go and get distracted by rabbit holes and other things and have a direct link. And I love, because of how Hook operates using those Apple scripts and things like that, if I move the file, it doesn't matter. You know, Hook respects file location. You know, if I delete the file, it'll even say, hey, it's in your trash. But, you know, sometimes that's not always the best thing. But it allows you to go in, write, you know, do what you're doing, link all the stuff together and not have to constantly go, where was that one thing that I did? And to me, that's the benefit and power of it.
Do you always use the same type of file or calendar event as the starting point, or does it vary?
And I've got videos coming out about this, not to shamelessly plug, but that is a good question. There are templates that you can use in Hook to say, like, if I'm starting a new research project, then you can have it open up Craft or open up BB Edit and create a document. Or even if you wanted to create a folder with a bunch of documents in it, you can do that using their templating system. The answer is kind of, I've developed, again, in your own contextual computing world, you have to know what tools you want to use. So I've kind of set up text expander snippets, Keyboard Maestro automations, bunch activations, all of these things to say, hey, I'm working on a new presentation, so let's get all that stuff put in place. And let's make sure it's all hooked together so that there's no confusion there. Same thing with like podcast interviews and stuff like that. That said, the different tools, I you know, there's a tool for every job. And sometimes those tools are the same, but in most cases, they're not.
See, for me, I use it in a slightly different way. So my day job is being a photographer. So the most important thing is knowing when and where you're going to be to shoot and take photos. So it will start off in Fantastical, which I can then plan what the weather's going to be like for that photo shoot, if it's outside or if it's indoors or however far I've got to go. But then everything involving that shoot links back to that calendar link. So that would be Pinterest with all the outfit ideas. It would be, what equipment list am I taking with you that's in reminders? It could be the email with the contact that I've been speaking to. But now I'm also looking at how I can use those with other applications. So it's taking the link and embedding it into something else. So for me, a lot of the problem is dealing with so many files, especially with photography, knowing which ones are edited, which ones you're going to throw away. Are they in the right format? Are they going to be shared to Instagram? So there is kind of like a background automation process that sits within that. And to be honest, it kind of works between Hook and Hazel of how they operate, especially from a file management process. But the one thing that triggers all of those is how they're tagged within the system, so that the machine or the software physically picks up that tag and then can activate whatever needs to be done.
So this all sounds fascinating from someone who's not got any of this, because what I'm now thinking of, what would be nice is when I go and see someone to repair their computer and I got this weird error message on the screen, what would be nice is to attach to the address and the calendar, the email address which got me there in the first place, the screenshots I take with the phone, any websites I look up whilst I'm there and what the messages were and how long I was there, so I know how much to charge the client. And would be nice if I could get all of that done in one go, and then it would be attached to a container. And the other thing which I could not quite understand is, if you're always seeing the same person and you're putting it into iCal, why can't iCal talk contacts to pick up the information? So if you are saying, I was going to go to Craig's house, it should be able to pick up Craig's address and put in a little address so I can tap on that and look at it in Apple Maps. But no, I have to do everything by hand because it won't link up. So it would be nice if I get someone to all automate it, I think.
We need to sign you up to CardHop.
Yeah, I was going to say Fantastical and CardHop's integration might help with some of that.
See, this is where I have to learn about the new features.
This is the stuff they don't teach you in Apple stores.
I'm a big BusyCal fan, so. But I guess I'll have to try Fantastical now. So.
The brilliant people as well, the people that run all that kind of thing at Flexibits, the great people.
And you can now get both of the apps for the same subscription price, which is awesome. That was their biggest upgrade recently. Well worth a look for sure.
You basically get CardHop for free if you already fantastic Owl subscriber.
And I'm also looking, apparently Hook does have some limited support for BusyCal if you're dead set on that.
Oh, thank you for that. But the other one, my other favorite app I would love, I would have to check on, would be Audio Hijack, which I'm a massive fan of. So
oh, that's a big one there. I have an email from Rogue Amoeba. Okay, I will only say I know the pain that Rogue Amoeba is going through with the M1 devices and all of those things. That said, they need to start working on some automation support. They don't have Apple scripting for Audio Hijack, which means that the closest thing you can get to automating it is looking for the image of what you're looking for and having it click with Keyboard Maestro, or as Brett Terpstra has done, having it literally send keyboard signals to go left and right a certain number of times and then hit enter, which is not acceptable for a program that is as fleshed out as Audio Hijack. And it only tickled that nerve a little because I've emailed them asking, because at one point it did have Apple Script support and they removed it and have then said, it's not a big enough demand, therefore we're not going to continue to support it. So yeah, that is, in the wrap up of contextual computing, that is always going to be the thing that you fight with, is what happens when the app just does not want to support it. What do you do? And the answer is, honestly, I don't fully know. Every situation is different.
Okay, I'm going to say thank you very much for both of you for joining us. Most importantly, where can we find each of you on the internet if we want to find out more? That's the most precious thing. Or what rabbit hole do we want to open?
Everywhere by the sounds of things.
Who would like to go first?
I'll let Jay go first. Go on.
So I've narrowed it down a little bit more. You can find me on Twitter at KJY Miller, YouTube at KJY Miller. There's a pattern here. Look for me on the thing at KJY Miller. If I'm there, I'm there. If I'm not, I'm not. The biggest things are the YouTube channel, Twitter. Keep an eye on that. I do have some announcements coming up about future content and things that I'm doing and where I'm speaking and presenting. And if you're a nerd, you know, especially if you're a developer that's not in the iOS and Apple side of things, if you do JavaScript or Python, reach out to me. I love having those conversations.
And I would personally say definitely look out for Jay's podcasts. And I know that he has something exciting coming up in the pipeline, which we're watching with eager eyes. And we'll also say thank you to our Mr. Imore with his wonderful headsets.
Many more knocking around somewhere.
Is this where you've got each colour?
Oh, don't. I've nearly bought different coloured ear cups because why not? And then I saw £79, and that's why not. That's that question answered. But anyway, thanks for having me. It's been a long time since I was on a podcast, so it's been great fun. Thank you for that. If you want to find me anywhere, Twitter's probably the best place, because if I start giving you URLs, we'll be here even longer. So twitter.com/OliverJHaslam, because someone's got my name on Twitter and never posted a tweet in their life. Not that I'm bitter about that one bit. So yeah, thank you very much.
I'd also say I wonder how you sleep, because you seem active on Twitter all the time.
I don't. It's called living on American time and having two kids.
And we'll also say thank you to Martin this evening. Thank you very much for joining us as always.
No, it's been a pleasure. Been informative. Learned a few new things, at least four more pieces of software I've got to go download, try, and then get rid of again after wasting hours and hours trying to get used to them. But that's the beauty. You do find the software that works for you. But thanks, guys. I've really enjoyed tonight.
Awesome. Thank you, Martin. And we'll also say thank you to our technical expert, Alistair, over there.
It's been a fun evening, and I've learned all about contextual computing. Thank you for the information. I'll go down a rabbit hole and start exploring it.
And I'll also say thank you from me, as always. Until next time, we will see you soon.